Testing, 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 testing. This is Betty Trunell, speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mr. Emanuel Rosenberg, known, I believe, better known as Manny to his friend. Well, Mr. Rosenberg, have you always lived in Decatur? Were you born here?
Yes, I was born in Decatur on North Clinton Street in 1898. And last September, of course, I passed my 80th birthday. I lived on the southeast side of Decatur and went to school first at Jackson School. Jackson School was located at the end of Jackson Street. It's a street that runs from Decatur south to Marion Street. I think the Decatur Public School has its maintenance department there now. Mm-hmm. I went to the grade schools there, and then I went to what they call the departmental school at the corner of North and Broadway.
What kind of school is that?
It's something like we have, the schools that they have, the 7th, the 8th, 9th, and 10th schools. And I remember the principal there was a man by the name of Harold. And then I went to the Stephen Decatur High School, and our class that graduated in 1915 was the first class that completed the entire four-year term in the high school when we graduated in 1915.
Then when they tore the building down, that was quite an event for you.
Yes, and I could see from my office on the 12th floor of the Citizens Building, I could look about down and see the big ball demolishing some very pleasant memories.
Right.
While I was in high school, I participated in a great many activities, one of which was I was on the debating team with some of my friends, and I remember an occasion when we went to Bloomington to debate the Bloomington High School on the question resolved that the telephone and telegraph line should be nationalized. And we had prepared for the affirmative side of the debate. And when we got to Bloomington, we found out we were to debate the negative.
And you could do that equally well.
Yeah, we did that, and miraculously, we won. Well, I can remember that on that team, I noticed in the paper just the other day that there was a Mrs. Davenport that died, was the widow of the police chief. Omer Davenport was one of the members of that debating team. After going through high school, I wasn't certain just as to what I should do, but I decided, through the urging of my parents and a lawyer friend in Chicago, that I should go to law school in Chicago at Northwestern University. Now, Northwestern University Law School at that time was on the corner of Dearborn and Lake Streets in downtown Chicago. And it was the site, the old Tremont Hotel, where Abraham Lincoln had visited and stayed when he was alive. And I started in 1918 and then enlisted in the Student Army Training Corps. And I was in the Army for 77 days. Our barracks were in the school. And our dining room, our mess hall was in the school, and we used to go out at 5 o'clock in the morning in formation to Grant Park, when the locomotives used to go up and down there belching out their smoke, as this was in 1918. And then we'd march back to the hall, and I remember that I weighed 165 pounds when I started school, and after my arm stint, I gained 25 pounds, because after we ate, we used to go and lie down on our cots, I remember. Then, of course, the war ended, and I was discharged from the Army 77 days after I started. And then I completed my education in 1920, and I came back here to start practicing law. And I started out by myself with an office over what was then the Parlor Market on Lincoln Square. I think that Radio Shack is there now on the west side of the what was known as Lincoln Square in those days, when the
urban went around the
square and the streetcars and so forth. And I know that I stayed in the office for a few months, and then I became an assistant state's attorney under Mr. Charles Evans. And I remained there for about 5 years until I got married in 1925. And I married Hannah Gebertz, who was the physical education supervisor in the public school. And she had come here from her home was in Whiting, Indiana. And we celebrated our 50th anniversary in 1975, and we're now in our 53rd year. And we, when I started the practice of law, of course, I was an assistant. The justice of the peace system was in vogue at that time, and it was nothing unusual to go over to the justice of peace and try a case for 1 or 2 days. One of the most interesting cases that I remember that we tried there involved we used to call them the Holy Rollers. They used to disturb the peace and quiet of neighborhoods. And we were very skeptical in the office about issuing a warrant for the complaints that coming in for disturbing the peace. They when people couldn't go to sleep and disturb the neighborhood. But finally, the complaints were so vociferous that we couldn't sidestep it, and we issued a warrant and arrested the pastor of the church for disturbing the peace.
You were afraid of freedom of religion.
Freedom of religion, freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
And we, in those days, when they could request a jury for a misdemeanor, which they can't do now, and they used to pick up the jurors in Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
People are there sitting on the benches. And we tried that case for 2 years, and I remember at the close of the case that I said my first piece, and the person, of course, who prosecutes has the burden of proof, and he gets the right to open and close. And the Reverend, when he got up to talk in defense of his position of having his church there, he quoted from the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
When I got up to reply, I quoted from the Old Testament. And I don't know, but the jury convicted him. And that stopped at least the obstreperous noises that they had, and they calmed down a little bit. And then when I got out of practice in the state attorney's office there, I opened up an office for myself in the Milliken building. And I was there for 4 years. And then I joined forces with Edward Hayes and Point Downing. Edward Hayes later became the national commander of the Legion. Point Downing also became the head of the Building and Loan Department of the state of Illinois.
An illustrious firm.
Yeah, very illustrious firm. But they left the office. They weren't in the office very much. And then I really carried on under the firm name for several years. But in 1942, my brother, Joseph, had come to town. And we joined forces in 1942. And we were together for many years, and then later Wayne Bickus joined our firm, and David Johnson, and then we have two other associates here. So now I'm in my 58th year of the practice of the law, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. Of course, the practice of law has changed over the years. For instance, when I started to practice law, if you wanted to get a divorce, you came to the lawyer's office, and you had to you were told that you had to pay $50 lawyer fees and $15 costs. And now that would only begin to pay the cost of a divorce today, because it's gone up to very, very high figures now.
Is it easier?
Well, of course, the divorce law in the early 20s was predicated on the fact that you had to, of course, be guilty of fault before you could get a divorce. We still retain in our system, even though we have a new divorce law passed October the 1st, 1977, we still retain the concept of fault. We are only one of two states in the United States and the Union today that retains the question of fault in divorce matters. Most of them have a no-fault procedure. Anyway, I was about to say that if you were a person that brought the suit and you got a divorce decree and were divorced, you couldn't get married for a year after the divorce. But if you were the defendant in that suit and you had committed adultery, you couldn't get married for 2 years. And the practice, of course, has got to the point now with divorces in the community, or it's a matter of no social stigma involved, and about half the number of marriages, that number of divorces occur every year. And then with the adoption of a new fault back about 6 or 7 years of extreme and repeated mental cruelty, divorces are, most of them are almost consent divorces, if they don't, there's no opposition and there's no question about the custody of children or property, and it goes through as a matter of course. But of course there's expertise in that, as there is in all fields, and I think that there's no more important branch of the law than taking care of human relations, making it possible for people to live together, either together or separately, but in order to eliminate bitter conflict, it is best, I think, that the law has indicated and finally come around to the point that people can't live together, they should be separate. And then, of course, now, when I came here, and when I started to practice law for myself in 1925 and then to 1929, practice of law has changed a great deal. There's been changes in the manner in which you file cases, the terms of court, and we have a system now that's much more flexible, makes it possible for people to get quicker justice, able to get to court quicker, and not the delays. We used to have a system that you could only go into court 3 terms of court. That would be the January, May, and October. And now all we do is we file a case and you have to appear 30 days after it and meet for speedier administration of justice. When I started the practice, I'd say, at least for myself in 1925, when June and July and August came in the summer, there was not very much court, you could almost shut up shop for those 3 months. Mm-hmm. But now it's a continual process the whole year along. I have found that we have a very splendid core of lawyers in Decatur, and I've enjoyed practicing law with them. Of course, there are a few bad apples in the barrel, but you get to know them and you accommodate yourself. I have, of course, been very active in community affairs. I early began to be a member of the Boys Opportunity Home in 1922, and I've been a member of that board since then, and when it merged with Webster Cantrell, I've continued.
Could you tell us what it is?
Well, the Boys Opportunity Home was originally founded by a group of women in the community, and it had always 11 women members and 10 men members. And its purpose was to provide a home for neglected children. Not bad boys, but boys that, for one reason or other, didn't have a proper home and needed temporary care so they could just be taken care of and put back in the mainstream of life. And over the years, the conception of what our institution is doing has changed. The good boys and the good girls now with the Webster Hall, it was the institution was, they merged a few years ago together, now on one roof. But there are not, the good girls and so-called good boys are no longer to be found in these institutions. They're all problem children involving special care, special skills, programs, recreation, facilities have to be provided for them, and so on. And it's, as they say, it's a different conception of what you should do with young children. And the State Department has changed its mind. At one time, they insisted that we should have not a correctional institution, but this kind of institution to take care of them. Then they want to put them in foster homes, and they've alternated depending upon who's in power, what administration, what their philosophy is. Today, I think the emphasis is to try to get them into the foster homes, but there is a place for a home like Webster Cantrell Hall if it's efficiently run. And I can say that right now, with the director, Mr. Althoff, out there, they're doing a splendid job of taking care of these
Now, is this still private, or is it a public?
They're all private, not-for-profit corporations, mm-hmm. with voluntary board of directors. Mm-hmm. But of course, they have a staff mm-hmm. of an expert man, social worker, who's the head of it, together with a large staff. Mm-hmm. And it's grown from maybe 5 or 10 people out to the home to maybe have 25 or 30 on the staff now. And the budgets, they vary from, say, when I first came on the board of the boys' home, there was no community fund, United Fund at all. Mm-hmm. And we had chickens out there, we mm-hmm. had a cow, and we really had to beg for the food for the boys. Mm-hmm. And it was a very difficult time until the community chest was the mm-hmm. forerunner of the United Way. And then when the community chest, then that started, we got a fixed budget. But over the years, we have been able to attract a great deal of requests that have been made in wills and land. So the home now owns 375 acres of farmland and has a tremendous endowment fund. Yes, mm-hmm. And then they get donations from people. And then the state now gives the major state and the county gives a major portion of the operating fund. Now, I was connected with that, and I was president of the Decatur Community Concerts. That was an organization that brought musical artists and attractions to the city, and that was based on the assumption that 1 week during the year we had a campaign. We had some 35, 50 people who were workers to go out to get memberships. Memberships used to be about $10 per person or $12 per person. We used to hold it at Masonic Temple. And we'd figure out how many members we had, and that would determine our budget. And our talent budget used to be around $8,000 a year. And out of that, we had to get 4 artists to come there a year. And we could get a symphony orchestra. In those days, the highest figure we paid was $3,500 today. Symphony orchestra, the cheapest is $9,000, mm-hmm. going up to $20,000 mm-hmm. for the symphony orchestra. Well, then, with the advent of the Illinois Arts Council and National Council, mm-hmm. the Arts and Humanities Council, we brought to Decatur, and I've been connected to them too, with the Decatur Arts Council. The Decatur Arts Council brought the Chicago Symphony mm-hmm. Orchestra for a week's residence. Mm-hmm. And it cost us $62,000, and the Illinois Arts Council contributed $50,000, and then we raised the $12,000. Mm-hmm. I was on the board of the Decatur Area Arts Council for 9 years, and I'm now a retired honorary member. I also was engaged as a member of the board of the Decatur Mental Health Center. Mm-hmm. And I was president there for several years, and then I relinquished that a few years ago. And I suppose that then there have been other organizations I've been connected with. I was for many years, starting way back in 1924 with a friend of mine who's now long gone, Horace Garman, we organized a lecture course at the YMCA on Sunday mm-hmm. afternoon. And then the community lectures, I took part in that, and that was organized in the late 30s and 40s. And we brought people like Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. Outstanding students, Dean Laswell, many, many people there to the Masonic Temple. And I have enjoyed living here in Decatur, and I had a chance when I got out of law school to go to Chicago, but my father was very ill, and he died 11 days after I became a lawyer. And so I stayed here, and I believe that the rewards of practicing in a small community are greater compared to that mm-hmm. to Chicago. There's not the rat race here mm-hmm. that there would be up there.
I'm sure you have contributed a great deal to the life of Decatur, too.
Well, I felt, I've been my philosophy that I think that being Jewish, that we have as one of the cardinal elements of our faith, that we have to have compassion for those who are not in the position to help themselves. We've got to help other people. And that, in effect, if you have something or money or wealth, that you're somewhat of a steward for those that have not. And I've been active, of course, in the United Fund years ago. And in Jewish causes, I have been president. I was president of our local synagogue for over 20 years. I'm an honorary president of the Temple of B'nai Abraham. I've been active in the United Jewish Appeal. It's the organization that has helped the suffering Jews overseas. Mm-hmm. And I was honored a few years ago for 25 years activity in that endeavor. I have two daughters, one daughter who's living in Israel, mm-hmm. with three grandsons.
Have you visited her?
We have been in Israel 10 times, mm-hmm. my wife and I, and my daughter is married to a doctor who is a professor of genetics, mm-hmm. and he has written several books on genetics, and he's writing a book now on Jewish diseases, mm-hmm. which will come out in June, and that the three boys are all in the Israeli army.
Oh.
One's a paratrooper, one's in the infantry, and the other's in the mm-hmm. artillery.
You must have a very great interest then in recent developments.
Yes, I have, of course, but I don't have the euphoria that many people think that the signing of the peace treaty is an end in itself. It's only the beginning of a long, hard
right.
struggle. And if you travel in Israel and they point out to you the small area in which Israel lives, you understand what they mean by security, that it's a nation of 3.5 million surrounded by 100 million Arabs. Mm-hmm. And what they have done in Israel has been truly remarkable. It's when we travel in Israel, we have all the comforts of modern living. Our daughter lives in a home that has 4 bedrooms, yes. all the appliances.
It does seem unfortunate that the other countries can't see that they could do the same.
That's right.
To help.
And actually what they've done is, agriculturally, they've done miracles,
yes,
over there,
yes.
made all this water to run uphill. They've eliminated some of the diseases which are endemic to tropical countries like trachoma. Mm-hmm. That's been eliminated. Their infant mortality rate is probably the lowest in mm-hmm. in the Middle East. The amount of their annual income, the average annual income of the Israeli is probably 10 or 12 times of those in the Arabic mm-hmm. countries, and all modern homes and buildings and so forth. And all that I say to people that travel in the Middle East, if they want to travel the experience of a lifetime, is to go to Israel, which is termed sometimes the Switzerland of Asia, mm-hmm. and see the contrast of going from an Arabic country and then stepping mm-hmm. into Israel.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of travel. We've made as I say, 10 trips to Israel, and then we've gone to Europe about 4 times. Mm-hmm. And in 1959, I toured some of the music capitals of Europe, like Zurich, Edinburgh, mm-hmm. and Glyburn, and so on, and Bayreuth in Germany. I always had a desire to hear Wagner mm-hmm. at the Festspielhaus there in Bayreuth, Germany. And although I knew that Wagner was mm-hmm. one of the greatest anti-Semites that ever lived, I still wanted to hear an mm-hmm. opera or two there. And we did go there in 1959 and enjoyed it very much.
Music then is one of your interests.
Yes, one of my interests, and then reading, of course, and then the law, and been connected with a small group of people. We call it the Fortnightly Club. It's a book club that meets every fortnight, every mm-hmm. 2 weeks. And we've been, my wife and I have been members since 1931.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good little commentary upon the change in social habits when we went there. The refreshments were Coke and popcorn. and now, They got to the point where at the social meetings we have wine and beer.
Mr. Rosenberg, you mentioned your daughter in Israel, but you also said you had another daughter.
Yes, I have a daughter living in Glenview, Illinois. It's married to an insurance man. And she has two sons, the oldest of which is graduating from a medical school this year. and her younger son is graduating from college. Mm-hmm. In addition, my daughter, Elaine, has been very active in the women's division of Brandeis University and will be installed as president of the National Brandeis Women's Organization in June of this year in Boston, and we're going to be there.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That will be a great event.
Yes, we're looking forward to it, and then we come back to my grandson's medical graduation, and it'll be quite a year for us.
Well, it is, and it not only has been quite a year for you, but it's been quite a life. And I thank you very much for sharing it with the people of Decatur, and we certainly appreciate all that you have done, and listening to these reminiscences has been a real pleasure.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much. You have been listening to the reminiscences of Mr. Emmanuel Rosenberg. This is Betty Turnell speaking for the Decatur Public Library.